the best one I think is probably to don't listen to people that tell you that your idea or your business is so special and so secret, you can't talk about it. Like, you need to talk to other people. Like, the worst advice I've ever gotten, basically, biggest mistake I made was early on thinking like, oh, this is some big secret. Like, no, who's going to go out and raise $5.5 million and plant a huge vineyard and, you know, do all this stuff? Like, if I don't actively network and be talking to people about what I'm doing, and if you don't, you know, you're going to miss out on opportunities big time.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Mason Moreland is a vineyard syndicator raising capital for developing and operating wine grape vineyards in the High Plains of Texas. His company, Texas Vine Country, focuses on large, scalable, and mechanized vineyard development. And as an aside and just almost weird note, he bred and sold geckos as a kid. I've heard of kids selling candy. I've heard of, like, you know, all sorts of stuff, man. But you definitely grew up, I guess, in the High Plains of Texas if you're buying and selling geckos. Is that about right, Mason?
Well, yeah, I think I'm a weirdo anywhere you put me for that, but doesn't matter geography. But yeah, I actually ended up going to school for herpetology. So yeah, studied all the scaly, creepy crawlies that nobody else likes. And yeah, been handling venomous snakes since I was like 12.
That's fantastic, man. I love it. Absolutely love it. Mason, there's three questions I ask every guest who comes on the show. In 90 seconds or less, can you tell me where you started, where you are now, and how you got there?
Yeah, I started selling geckos, apparently. Started out with right out of school doing just my W-2 environmental consulting, and immediately started investing in single family homes with my dad and my brother. So started buying, you know, one home at a time, bought one and lived in it, did the whole house hack thing. And then after we got up to about, you know, like $3 million worth of single family homes and townhomes and stuff, we were like, this isn't very scalable, right? So where we went from there was to look towards multifamily, right? Like most people do when they're trying to scale and grow. And we failed at our first deal. It was, you know, we went out of contract in the due diligence phase, and I kind of went down a different road, ended up underwriting vineyards and found that, hey, there's a big gap in the market here for me to attack using the things that I've learned in real estate. So where we are now is really that we've taken all those skills that we've learned in real estate, found the right team, brought everybody together to make scalable, large vineyards a possibility to attack the market gap that we identified. And now where we're going is we're using those same methods from business and real estate, like syndication, you know, more sophisticated financing and things like that, to actually grow and outpace any of the competition in the area.
Right, man. That's tremendous. I want to dig in a little bit more on that. Rewind a little bit. You said your first multifamily deal, it was that you failed at it. What did that mean?
Yeah. So I say we failed. I think we succeeded because we did the right thing. I think that's the key takeaway there. It was, we tried to buy it off all by ourselves. So just me and my brother and my dad, and we got to the physical due diligence phase of things and had it under contract and, you know, paid out all our, you know, non-refundable portions of our monies, you know, it's the expensive phase.
Right.
And got in there and started looking at things, and it's, you know, class C property, you know, just safety and morally, we couldn't find a way that we could make money off of this place. Essentially, to get it up to snuff where we felt the tenants were safe in there, it would take too much money and we wouldn't make anything. And if we left it as is and continued to make money, it would be immoral for us to do that. So we decided to back away from that deal.
Gotcha. And so from there, then you found a market gap in the vineyard space.
Exactly. Just using the, you know, networking. Like, so I knew, you know, one of my friends worked for our current director of vineyard management, started pinging him like, hey, give me, you know, what do you know? What are you doing? And met Rusty, started getting numbers and underwriting what they were doing in the same way that we do here. There's a lot less sophistication in the ag world, at least on this scale, you know, with vineyards and alternative permanent crops. You know, most people do it on a napkin. They're like, hey, it pencils out, let's go. You know, meanwhile, I'm over here with my 19 sheet spreadsheet that's modeling out 30 to 50 years of a vineyard's life with like different refinances and all these crazy variables. So it's a whole different level.
Right. That is a whole different level. So now you guys are buying raw land and developing vineyards. Is that right?
Yeah. So the 10-second version of our business plan essentially is there's a big gap in production for mid-price fruit for wineries in the state of Texas. What we do is we go raise money, the same way a multifamily syndicate would, from investors. We go out and we buy pieces of raw land that are currently in row crop agriculture. So they're irrigated, pivot sprinkler system on it. And we go in and we install vineyards and then we run them. And we do it in a West Coast style, like mechanized, two or three people instead of 40 to 60 on a half section. So drastically reduce the operating costs and boost the yields by a lot.
Now, the High Plains of Texas, what's the water situation like there?
It's definitely one of the better areas where we're at, but it's very contentious. So water here is your biggest asset by far, only followed by soil, because there is no surface water here.
Right.
That's a very unique thing about the High Plains. There's basically no rivers. It's all groundwater. So what happens is as it rains, it goes into these small depressions called Playa Lakes, percolates down into the water table in the Ogallala Aquifer and slowly recharges. So we use groundwater here to irrigate during the season we need a little bit, usually in the fall. So we have to be very careful to preserve that. Now with cotton, peanuts, traditional crops, you know, you're using up to 3 acre feet of water a year. Grapes, I mean, we're pushing huge crops and still, you know, maybe 1 acre foot. So we're actually able to operate in areas where other folks have pulled out of irrigated crop.
Yeah, right. Yeah, because if your water uses a third that of your row crop competitor, you can go in and do things that other people, again, your row crop guys, if they're pulling out, they just can't. You use the term mid-price fruit. That means absolutely nothing to me. And so you have this opportunity to fill a gap in the market by mid-price. What is that? Break that down. I don't even know the question to ask.
So let me give you some like concept of scale, right? So in Texas, our average price per ton, so it's all the fruits sold by ton.
Okay.
Average price per ton for like a nice, decent red grape is maybe like $2,000 to $2,700, $2,800, even $2,900 a ton. Okay. And for a similar quality fruit in areas of California where it's mechanized production, you can buy fruit for maybe $700 or $800 a ton, even less sometimes. An equivalent fruit that, you know, you can find it down to $350 a ton in some parts of California. Equivalent fruit in Texas would cost still $1,700, you know, $1,800 a ton even sometimes. So where there's a big gap for us is Texas produces, you know, only maybe half of the fruit that they use. So that stuff that's between, say, so on the price range of fruit, you know, you're looking at, you know, half of our fruit is basically not produced in the state. It's trucked in as bulk wine from the West Coast.
Right.
So if you can't push that price of fruit below that, you know, $1,700 a ton in Texas, we will never be able to offer the same bang for your buck on the bottle of wine as California can, because it's still, you know, equivalent $8 or $10 bottle of wine in California, you're just not going to find that same quality at that same price from a Texas wine right now. And that's really where the biggest gap that we're attacking is.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I don't know anything about wine. Okay, let's just start there. But I understand that geography plays a large part of what a wine could taste like. So, I mean, you guys have figured out that there's a region in Texas that you can produce decent wine. I mean, how'd you even figure all that out? Where did you start on that process?
Oh, standing on the shoulders of giants. So lots of people have been messing with wine grapes in the state of Texas for a very long time. You know, some of the first ones to get planted were, gosh, potentially as far back as the 1600s with, you know, some of the Spaniards that were coming through here, potentially planting some European vines. But people have been messing with vines for a long time in the state of Texas. Actually, most of the rootstock that vines sit on across the world right now actually originated in the state of Texas, so as native grapes. But, you know, the way we really figured out where can we do this is Rusty, our director of vineyard management. He's managed vineyards from Lubbock all the way down to Houston, which is like a 9-hour drive to give you some context of how big of an area that is. It's from 80% humidity to 20. Big climate difference, right? So what he's seen is, you know, the price just to operate in, say, Fredericksburg, the Hill Country area that everybody thinks of for Texas wine, dirty little secret is 70 to 80% of the grapes are actually produced up here on the High Plains because the operational costs are half just from the lower humidity, you know, better wind, things like that, less disease pressure.
Yeah, that's absolutely amazing. What are some projects you guys have underway right now? And what are some challenges or just kind of unique things that, you know, because this is commercial real estate syndication. I mean, it's all business, but it's all commercial real estate syndication still. Like, what are some projects you guys have underway? What are some challenges you're facing? How are you guys overcoming those? I mean, what's that look like?
So we've got really two main projects going on right now. We've got our 2022 planting happening right now. So got, you know, land under contract, got T-posts and vines all lined up. The biggest difficulty and challenge with that one was definitely that was our first true syndicated vineyard and really figuring out how do we present an opportunity like this to investors where, you know, they're used to seeing, you know, maybe a 5-year hold period and it's starting to cash flow within, you know, maybe a month or two of them buying the property. where it's taken us 5 years to get up to full production and they're not seeing anything till year four, you know, and it's going to last for potentially 50 or 100 plus years. Right. How do we model this out and present it? That was difficult. And then the other, by far the most challenging thing I've ever done in my life, and I have 3 going on 4 kids, so that says something, is this custom crush facility that we're building. It's basically a winery co-packer. And what it does is it offers, you know, winemaking services, fruit processing, things like that to other wineries as a service. And the financing on that, especially in an area where there's nothing like that, you know, there's very few custom crush facilities out here in Texas compared to the West Coast. That has been incredibly difficult. Learning how to do that and finding the right people and networking, just incredible.
What was the raise? Let's talk dollars and cents. What, I mean, tell us the size of the vineyard you're building right now.
So the size we're building, we set it based on how much can we keep one set of people and equipment busy full time, right? So we maximize our efficiencies, our economies of scale. It's about 300 acres, so it's 290 acres. And we've got room to add maybe another 10, 15 acres on there and still use the same set of equipment. But the raise on our typical size is a half square mile, which comes out to about 290, 300 acres of vines, is about $5.5 million raise. So your total capital stack is actually pretty equity heavy in this. So you're going in with a pretty strong position on the property just because ag loans, you can only get maybe 65% LTV. So you're going in with pretty good strength there.
What? And you say 65, who finances those?
Typically for projects like this and a lot of ag projects, you're going to use like, it's called an FCS, Farm Credit Service. Yeah. It's basically like a bank that operates within the ag space.
Got it. That's really interesting. Now you said that, you know, 5 million is pretty equity heavy. So the total project at 60, what is that, roughly a $20 million project then?
Yeah. Well, actually, because so like I said, it takes like 5 years to get up to full production levels. So you're actually having to operate that thing for, you know, 4.5 years before you're seeing major production.
Right.
So you've actually got to raise money on the front end to operate too. So it's about 50-50 equity debt. Pretty close.
Wow. What's the pitch to investors? I mean, that seems like that would be a hard pitch. Hey, we're going to go great, grow grapes. We're not sure if we're ever get it off the ground. It's going to be amazing or the it could all suck. So I'm just imagining here, but what's that like?
100%. That was the hardest thing to learn is like, okay, there's people that this is definitely not for, right? If you're looking for like super high velocity of money, yeah, probably not your guy, but that's okay. That's not my jam, right? So, you know, what we had to do is realize like, okay, right now we've got really good returns, right? Stupid returns if you're looking at just doing it as a partnership, like a JV, right? Everybody's just putting cash in, going out and getting a loan and doing it within 2 or 3 partners. Now, if you're syndicating it, you got to spread that out a little bit. But to get the IRR, so the return over time to match what people are used to, you know, that like 10 to 20 IRR in that range, you've got to get a pretty good yield on it. So thankfully with what we do, it's so competitive that, you know, we really are able to offer, you know, well over 20% yearly cash on cash stabilized. So it's, you know, it's different in that it's going to last more than 5 years. So it's really for those investors that want to put their money in something that is going to cash flow, is going to be a large value add. You know, you're going from, you know, a few $1,000s an acre to, you know, $50,000 an acre in value. So got a big jump. And then we'll see cash flow for a really long time coming off of it that tracks with inflation. So it's good for that. It's a good legacy investment.
Right. Is there the hope that someday you sell these off just like a typical, hey, 5 to 10 year, we're going to get this thing stabilized, get it start making money, and then we're going to sell it off? Or is there, like you said, the plan to hold it long term?
You know, like everybody else, we build it in with several exit strategies. One of them is definitely to sell. You know, we want to build it so that it's attractive. It gives us another opportunity. So our main exit strategy, so to speak, is to hold it and cash flow it, right? But our secondary exit strategies are, hey, we need to build this like the wine majors do on the West Coast so that they're familiar with what we're doing and our operations make sense to them. So, you know, we're looking at like the Wine Group, E&J Gallo, Constellation, how do they run their vineyards? And we take those concepts and apply them here so that, you know, it's a seamless transition if they ever do get interest in the state of Texas. And now the other exit strategy, of course, is the, you know, hold it and refi. You know, that's also a really great option to get a good slug of tax advantage capital as well.
Yeah, let's talk about that for a second. What are the tax advantages? I mean, you know, a lot of times we're looking at depreciation of buildings, we're looking at bonus depreciation, stuff like that. I mean, raw land and development, is there, do you have the tax advantages you typically do in other asset classes?
Yeah, absolutely. You do. So, you know, we do cost segregation studies, literally, like, you know, I've got, you know, like Madison specs and stuff, you know, the people you see everywhere on the multifamily doing the same thing on the vineyards, because we still have major capital improvements that are going on to the land. Of course, you can't depreciate the land. But, you know, when you have 43 truckloads of T-posts at, you know, 230,000 T-posts and, you know, thousands of tons of wire and, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of ripples and, you know, a building and an AC unit and a bunk room for the staff and all that stuff, you've got a lot of things that you can depreciate. A lot of it's on a 7-year scale. Now, as things are sort of changing, that could all change, of course. So whenever you're listening to this, this could all be different when you're listening to this. But yeah, there are good tax advantages, and we do cost segregation and bonus depreciation where we can, just like everybody else.
Right, man, that's fantastic. I love learning about this. This is a lot of fun. I love what you're doing. I love the unique pivot. I mean, that's one of the things that a lot of people are afraid to do, is when they say, okay, I'm in multifamily, I realized that wasn't for me. We quote unquote failed, but then we saw another opportunity, and here you are developing hundreds of acres and vineyards and doing lots of cool stuff. I think that's
absolutely— Dude, it's scary. When you first decide to do, you know, think like, am I going to do this? You know, it's scary.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. But here you are. And
yeah, survived. You can do it too. Everyone else can. Right. Find your niche.
Absolutely. Anything else you want to share with our listeners here before we jump into the final four questions?
You know, really, I guess to talk about that, just if you see something that's interesting to you, don't underwrite it. Like if it's a business, you know, just figure out how they work. It's so cool. Like I love doing that. And I still do that to this day. If I see a business that I don't know much about, I'll go figure out how it works, figure out how they solve the problems in their business. And maybe I'll find something that I can apply to mine.
Right, man. That's fantastic. Mason, thank you for your time today. Here we go. Final four questions. What is one software or tool you find you can't live without?
Oh gosh, probably Google Earth. I'm a Google Earth addict. And since we do so much land work, I obviously you're using CAD tools all the time, but just being able to bring it all into one program. Close second would actually be a hunting software. It's OnX Maps. So like on the letter X Maps. It has, you know, you can use GPS on your phone offline with or without service if you download the maps beforehand, and it gives you property owner data, property lines. You can drop points. It's awesome. It's really good for real estate as well as, you know, if you like to hunt.
Huh. That's fantastic. I love that. If you could help our listeners avoid one mistake in real estate, what would it be and how would you avoid it?
Oh, absolutely. That's the best one. So two, but the best one I think is probably to don't listen to people that tell you that your idea or your business is so special and so secret, you can't talk about it. Like you need to talk to other people. Like the worst advice I've ever gotten, basically biggest mistake I made, was early on thinking like, oh, this is some big secret. Like, no, who's going to go out and raise $5.5 million and plant a huge vineyard and, you know, do all this stuff. Like if I don't actively network and be talking to people about what I'm doing, and if you don't, you know, you're going to miss out on opportunities big time.
Yeah, absolutely. When it comes to investing in the world, what's one thing you're doing right now to make the world a better place?
And right now, so I am really trying to focus on giving back, especially through our church. So any of the money that I'm making, you know, I haven't been good in the past with actually putting capital back in. You know, I've just been going, working. And now it's like, okay, I'm actually making some money and like things are going good. Let's give back and make sure that our community is seeing some of that.
Yeah, absolutely. That's really cool. And hey, look, you know, they've got the provider of the communion wine right there.
I know. We actually had so this vineyard out behind us, not all of our partners, but a good chunk, maybe like half of us are Catholic. And we actually had the bishop come out, and he actually did like a blessing of the vineyard out at Rusty's house. And it was great. It was pretty cool.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Mason, if our listeners want to get in touch with you, learn how to invest with you, or learn more about you, what is the best way to do that?
So guilty habit. I'm a LinkedIn junkie. I'm on LinkedIn all the time. So if you want to get me like real fast, just message me on LinkedIn or send me a connection request with a little message on it. Happy to help out any way I can. I'm an open book. Also, you can find us on texasvinecountry.com. That's our website, and kind of shows who we are, what do we do, and how do you get involved?
Fantastic. Yeah, I'm going to make sure we put both of those links there in the show notes. Mason, awesome. Thank you for your time today. I do appreciate it.
Hey, man. Pleasure, Sam. Thanks for having me.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen, if you can do that for us, That would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much, and hope to catch you on the next episode.